Hello everybody and welcome to another episode. In this episode we're going to talk about virtualization. I'm Mark Clark, I'm from South Africa and I'm an open source developer and solution architect. Yeah, the work I do is basically involves using open source components to build solutions, and also do a lot of coding in Java and PHP to glue the solutions together.
All right, and my name is Darlene Parker and I'm from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And I work with a Linux-based development company, and my role is to work with people around the world to integrate open-source solutions into various verticals such as schools, governments, business, and so on.
Okay, well, how's the weather in Canada today, Dolly?
Well, it was so beautiful over the weekend, Mark, and now, yeah, it's springtime in Alberta, and that means it can be 18 above one day and snow the next. So today's a little overcast. Today's a little overcast, but I'm sure glad we're finished with our 40 below, and you guys have had 40 above. So
yeah, it's been Easter weekend this weekend, yeah. So it's been, the weather's actually been quite nice. Yeah, it's getting to autumn, yeah. It gets a bit cold and miserable. Everything dies off. Yeah, it only gets to as low as 0 degrees, which we consider pretty cold over here. But yeah, so you guys are getting summer and spring there, and we going into our winter this side.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. So when I plan my trip there, I'm going to come. Actually, I have to delay my trip a little bit, so I'm going to come the middle of July, August. I was told it's still not too hot, so 25, 30 degrees, I can live with that.
Yeah, no, that's midwinter. Yeah, it's a bit miserable, cold. It gets to about zero sometimes, you know, in the morning. So that's when you don't want to get out of bed. Okay, but today we're going to talk about virtualization. So first, let's consider what is virtualization?
All right, well, in my viewpoint, it's where you can utilize the resources of your PC processor and your server processor, where you can allow multiple applications and operating systems to coexist, and it reduces your power, your cooling, and space requirements on your server room. How do you see it, Mark?
Yeah, virtualization, as you say, it enables you to run multiple OSs of one piece of iron, as they say, or base metal. So what you can do is you can have two or three server operating systems running off of the same machine, and the machine looks as if it's, you know, it's serving those three operating systems all at the same time. Obviously, it's doing multitasking and time splicing at the processor level, but it enables you to essentially install three separate operating systems however many you want, actually. And it's all self-contained. So the operating system thinks it's actually running on real hardware, when it's not. It's actually running on virtualized hardware. I mean, that, in a nutshell, is how I understand virtualization.
Right. And, you know, and with the new dual core and quad core platforms that we have now, you're able to run, you know, like you say, the three or four OSs on there without any problems. And as well, I know that we use the virtualization for our development of our software and testing the applications so that they can be deployed on a much faster basis with a high degree of confidence.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the benefits of virtualization, is that ability to take images of your environments. And it's quite nice, as you're saying, for development, because you can take snapshots of your production environment and use it to refresh your dev environment. So now you don't have that problem you traditionally had in the past of trying to sync dev and production environments. You know, so you always have some application, some bug that only manifests itself in production, and you can never get it to manifest itself in dev, no matter how hard you try. Now it's a lot easier, because you can just snapshot the production environment and move it over to dev. So it's definitely got advantages in that. I mean, the other advantages of virtualization, as you touched on, include things like server consolidation. So there's an immediate cost saving there in terms of, you know, having 10 servers. Now you've got one with 10 machines running on top of it. You know, what I do find bizarre is a few years ago, I remember when we did some work for the banks, you know, they would always buy these machines which were way over-specced. You know, like they'll get like some small web server thing with some internal department and have 4 gigs of RAM. You think, you know, the thing only needs about a gig of RAM, and it'll be like a quad processor box or a four-way box. And that's overkill. And now suddenly, you know, all of the vendors and everybody's turning around and saying, oh, you know, you also got all this spare capacity in your data center, all this underutilized capacity. And you kind of wonder, well, you know, who's responsible for that? because I sold them all this hardware in the first place. But yeah, you know, I think there's this realization now that a lot of the resources underutilized in the data center, and better use can be made of it by consolidating it. So instead of having three machines that are only using 30% of the resources, you know, I have one machine that's using, you know, up to 90% of the resources. So there's a cost savings there, and not only is there cost savings in terms of you know, not having to maintain 10 different boxes and having 10 different pieces of hardware that can fail, there's also much lower power consumption, which is you know, a big issue these days. Everybody's looking for more environmentally friendly methods of carrying on business, especially with, you know, most of the world is now in an energy crisis. I mean, like here in South Africa, for example, we're running out of power reserve margin in the power stations because of lack of planning. So all these things are issues that people, you know, why people are looking at virtualization.
Right, and along with the power, so having 10 less or 9 less servers running as well, you're not cooling that server room for 9 more servers as well, because that's always a big power draw.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, South Africa, you know, South Africa had some of the cheapest power in the world for the last 10 years, and we all realize now, wow, because basically they weren't investing in infrastructure. So, I mean, South Africa, people have very, what would you call it, lax attitude towards electricity, but it's having to change now. And as you say, not only is there power saving, because government is going to introduce penalties just now for heavy users of electricity, but there's also all the savings in space in your server room, cooling, everything. So yeah, it has a multiplier effect on, and it's also as well, like now you only have one administrator can look after one box, as opposed to having two administrators look after 10 boxes or something like that. So all around, it's much more efficient and much more productive to consider virtualization of your servers.
Right, and also want to touch today too, though, Mark, is that there are actually two types of virtualization, right? There's desktop virtualization and the server virtualization, which we've been speaking about. Mm-hmm. So maybe today I can talk a little bit about the desktop virtualization, and Mark, you can pick up on the server side of it for us.
Okay, great, yeah.
All right. So I just want to say that, you know, virtual desktop infrastructure, it takes the concept of the virtual machine and uses it to run multiple PC client instances. Most people think of thin clients when they think of this, but there are numerous products out on the market, both Linux and Windows-based, that allows each user to have their own unique environment, and you can customize them with different apps and settings without impacting the other users. And they're just, good for applications that were not multi-user friendly can be run in this environment as well. So, Mark, some of the versions, so there's a couple of different ways, different approaches to that. There's some that have multiple OSs where they allow you to, so like on my laptop, I can run Vista and Ubuntu. And so those are products like VirtualBox, VMware, Parallels, which is mostly on a Mac platform. And then you also have the true desktop virtualization products, like the Linux-based ones such as Userful, or Windows-based products such as SoftExpand. Mark, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, look, most of my experience is with virtualization on the server side. The desktop mm-hmm. side is very limited for me. The only time I really use it on the desktop side is when I'm trying out new Linux distributions to see how they work, or if I want to try something which potentially can mess up my system, then I will... then I'll launch a virtual machine for it. I typically use VirtualBox on Linux. Yes. VirtualBox is completely free and open source. I know Sun bought it and they changed the license. I think they open sourced it completely now, which is why I prefer it. Another firm favorite with Linux, of course, is VMware desktop. I haven't really used VMware that much, mainly because of its proprietary nature. They just feel that once you start using it, eventually you'll get trapped in it and you have to start... somewhere along the line, they're going to turn around and ask you for licensing fees. But
right.
My experience with the way, you know, there's definitely a difference in the way the desktop virtualization works as compared to like server virtualization. Because desktop virtualization basically runs on top of the operating system. So you load your operating system, then you load the virtual environment, which will launch your virtual machines. So the hypervisor sits on top of the base operating system, as it were, or the virtual machine manager. Whereas with server machines, basically the hypervisor loads first, and then the host operating system loads, and then the guest operating system run on top of that. So there's a slight difference in how they work. One of the things I do find is that in my experience, you know, when I hear a lot of people talking about desktop virtualization, they say how fast it is and how snappy. And maybe I just got underpowered machines and I don't buy beefy enough machines, but I normally find that, you know, there's a definite slowdown in the desktop environment that you're working in when you virtualize the machines, the desktops there. So, you know, to me, it's not practical to work in a virtual desktop constantly. You know, as an environment, you want to try and test some various things, that's okay. But personally, I don't find it that snappy. But as I say, maybe it's just because typically the machines I buy in South Africa, they only have like 1 gig of memory and you know, the entry-level processors. Maybe overseas,
right.
We hear a lot more of these reports, some people can afford, you know, more beefier hardware.
Right. Okay, well, Mark, so my side of it is that, so of course, you know, we want people to try these on things that are dual-core, quad-core. And if you're only doing one or two users, I mean, you could get away with a Pentium D or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for us, my suggestion is, like, with the multi-OSs, I'm just going to give a real-life example of what I use it for. So I had a new salesperson who needed to learn some Linux. Mm-hmm. But she has a Vista laptop, and that's what she's familiar with. And she was, you know, but I needed to train her, so I loaded on VirtualBox for her so I could have Ubuntu running so she could actually play with it and learn a little bit about what she had to talk about to people. And then on the desktop virtualization side, you're right, it does load on top of the OS and expands it from there. And yeah, this is where you need that higher processor. Even myself, when I loaded VirtualBox this over the weekend, I took the highest, you know, the best quad processor we had in the building to load it on, because I knew that the Windows would drag it down. And also I had four stations running on it with the multiple OSs. But what I wanted to say, though, is that the same thing we talked about on the server side applies on the desktop side. So with the green computing, with the reduction in power draw, so instead of 10 desktop PCs, you only have one. Like, say, for example, instead of, you know, you have 10, eliminate 9 out of that mix. You're not cooling down the office or the classroom or the computer lab where all these things are running, and they tend to be left running. I don't know about in South Africa, but in North America, school labs are left running 24/7, and I heard that that's also the case in the UK because they're really moving towards a zero carbon footprints for their schools there.
I was going to say, I mean, in South Africa, typically a lot of computers are left on 24/7, but that's, you know, that's because in the early days of computing, everyone was told it's better to leave your machine running than to turn it on and off every morning, or turn it off in the evenings and turn it on in the morning because of the power surge could damage the machine. So it's sort of like a bit of a cultural thing now, it would just leave the machines on because they've been told that it's the best thing to do.
Okay, so anyway, so that's my input on the desktop side, just that you're just utilizing, because you know, if you look at like you say, the bank, you used the example of the bank that bought, you know, the way too much hardware for what they really needed, and in here, I know here in North America, people are sold these I call them SUV computers that they'll never use. They'll never use the full capacity of those computers, right? The guy at the computer store will sell them the moon, and so what we believe is that the, you know, organizations can actually utilize the full capacity of those computers by layering on top of these virtualization programs.
Yeah, look, there's many advantages in the hardware. It's you know, you can't overemphasize the advantages that it has, virtualization for usage of your hardware. You know, it gives you the ability now to basically treat your hardware like a resource pool that you can reallocate, you know, almost at will to wherever you need the processing power. So, you know, the move happened a while ago with disks in terms of SAN disks and, you know, central disk storage. Now it's happening with CPUs and memory. And you can allocate, you know, resources to your applications by just clicking a few buttons. So this is also obviously predominantly in the server environment, where you can just dynamically allocate resources to your machines. And so typical scenarios that people use is like a machine that's a process that runs during the day. Like, let's say you're at the bank and you know, you have your online web server processing all the transactions, but in the evenings another machine has to start up and, you know, it takes over most of the resources and starts doing its batch processing. Now you can have one machine that's busy 24 hours a day rather than having two machines that are busy half the time. So that's where the most exciting prospects with server virtualization actually lie, which is that ability to live migrate your your servers from one machine to the next. You know, and this also has the advantage if hardware fails, it doesn't mean that your server goes down. You can live migrate it to another machine. It'll take over the other virtual machine will take over the processing of that application, and so you have a lot more redundancy and a lot more flexibility with your applications and how you deploy it. That's one of the advantages on the server side. And one of the things you did talk about was running Windows as a guest OS on top of Linux. Because let me just explain, there's a couple of there's full virtualization, which was the first virtualization which came out, which basically emulated virtualized the entire hardware stack. And that was extremely slow. So you had QME, it was one of the first ones that came out, and VMware as well did it. You would have you really just a powerful machine to be able to process that guest OS at any sort of reasonable speed. And then what happened was called paravirtualization. What paravirtualization does, it needs the kernel of the guest OS to be aware that it is running in a virtual machine, and therefore it's got special APIs that it talks to the host OS or the hypervisor by those APIs. So essentially what it does is it doesn't virtualize all of the hardware, only virtualizes some of it. And this, gives a great speed improvement to virtualization. So when I first became aware of the sort of the explosion in virtualization was when they started talking about Xen in Linux, and Xen was a paravirtualized virtual machine, so or hypervisor. And then you could see it definitely, you could run servers, three servers in one machine, and they were quite snappy and responsive. However, you couldn't run Windows guests, because Windows, you'd have to modify the kernel, so it became aware that it was running in a virtualized environment. And of course, because Windows is not open source, you can't do that, whereas with Linux you could. And of course, it wasn't in Microsoft's interest to allow people to do that.
Right.
But then what happened is the hardware manufacturers, Intel and AMD, basically introduced hardware switches or in the CPUs. They introduced some hardware change which enabled you to run Windows in a guest environment. Windows is actually unaware that it's in a guest environment. So I'm not all familiar with the whole technology around it. I know it's got to do with the Ring Zero, which is a protected mode that's running in the kernel, and how the kernel knows it's in Ring Zero and all this kind of stuff. But essentially, it fools the guest OS into believing that it's running securely in Ring Zero. So yeah, so now that you have that, you have the what's called hardware-assisted virtualization. So if anybody's buying CPUs and they want to use virtualization, want to make sure they get the best speed out of it, just look and see. I can't remember exactly the extensions that Intel and AMD CPUs must support to provide this. But yeah, you must just make sure that you're buying processors with those extensions. And in fact, I mean, most of the modern processors, I think all of the modern processors have those extensions by default these days.
Yeah, I have some notes here. It says Intel VT or AMD V. So maybe those are the x86 processors that they have this virtualization done for.
Yeah, normally you can go you can just list proc CPU info and then you'll see it there. And you've got to look for those strings that you mentioned, and then you'll know if your CPU supports it or not. Okay, so one of the things I'd like to just talk about quickly is give a quick overview of the virtualization technologies that are available on Linux. I have experience with Xen, hypervisor, and then also KVM, kernel module. Xen was the first hypervisor that I started using on Linux. That was back in the days when you had to compile it and install it from scratch and all of that kind of stuff. Nowadays, a lot easier. Most distributions have a Xen-enabled kernel already available, so you can just apt-get it or yum install it and that kind of stuff, and it's there and it's running. So Xen was the one that sort of brought it to the fore in the Linux world, although there was a whole history behind it, as you mentioned, Darlene, before that. And I must say, Xen I find quite usable, easy to use, easy to set up, and you managed everything from the command line. And obviously it was in small installations, and it was very stable, and delivered on what it said it did. Then it wasn't officially included in the Linux kernel, of course. And eventually Linux included a KVM, or the kernel virtual machine, which essentially is a kernel that runs on top of Linux, or runs in Linux. I'm not that much of a kernel developer or knowledgeable in that area at all, but the way I understand it, KVM basically, with Xen, would load the hypervisor first, and then it would load the Linux kernel on top of that, what is called DOM0, or the host operating system. So essentially the hypervisor would have control of the actual hardware. Whereas with KVM, essentially Linux loads, and then it loads the virtual machine, or the hypervisor is a module in the Linux kernel. So it's much more, it's the Linux kernel is in control rather than the hypervisor in control. I've used KVM as well. You know, and both of them are as much of a muchness. They basically both work. One of the differences is that KVM doesn't support paravirtualization. So if you want to, you can't run. If you have a CPU, it doesn't support those extensions that we talked about that enable you to run unmodified Windows OSs as guests. You can't run Windows in it because it requires that those CPUs. Whereas Xen allows you to use older hardware where you can then virtualize Windows and other Linux operating systems. So yeah, as I said, most of them are much of a muchness. It seems that you know the distributions are all picking and choosing which virtual machine they're going to support. So it looks like SUSE is sort of stacking up behind Xen. Red Hat was using Xen, but then Xen got bought out by Citrix, and now they're moving more towards KVM. And so yeah, that's my experience with the server-side virtual machines. I haven't used VMware at all, and I haven't used Parallels. Well, I'm not even sure if Parallels is a server virtualization environment or just a desktop virtualization environment.
Okay, Mark, so do we want to talk about maybe some of the pros and cons that go with virtualization?
Yeah, okay. I think we covered a lot of the pros of virtualization already, but on the con side, networking, you know, because now you're working in a virtual environment and you have virtual network cards, all of these different virtual machines, sometimes that can become quite complex. And one of the key things then is how you handle routing and your firewalling and your, you know, like let's say you've got IP tables set up, how you handle that to make sure that you route the packets appropriately. So one of the issues, a lot of the vendors don't really have a proper response to it, is around security around virtual machines. Because now if you have like your DOM, let's say your host operating system gets hacked, all your guest operating systems are basically vulnerable then, because that obviously has special access to the guest operating systems. And also, you know, you can imagine these nightmare scenarios where you've got a huge data center with virtual machines just being migrated from, you know, because the machine's no longer stuck on a particular piece of hardware. Somebody would just launch a fake virtual machine or hack a virtual machine. They could just migrate it around the data center, and it would be almost impossible to stop if they're smart enough in handling it. I think at this point, what's stopping a lot of, you know, things from happening is that it's still new technologies and no one's really up to speed with all of its vulnerabilities and issues at the moment. But I'm sure we'll see that coming through, and obviously there will be a response from the security side and how to deal with that as well. But I think it's a young technology, and we're still yet to see how we're going to deal with that kind of scenario. And also, maybe it's not an issue. You know, I remember I went to a Novell Microsoft Interop meeting, you know, and one of the guys there asked the Microsoft guy, so, you know, what about security on your virtual machines? You know, and the chap said, no, you know, it's a very small kernel, it's really pared down, and it's basically it's unhackable, you know, and the whole room burst out laughing, you know. So, yeah, so yeah. I guess what I'm saying is I wouldn't run Windows as my hypervisor. I think then you're asking for trouble, so.
Right. But actually, it's funny that you would say that it's a young technology, Mark, because actually as I was reading and preparing for today, IBM had been working on virtualization for the last 40 years. Can you believe that? It just hasn't become mainstream. But it's been around in the background and building ever since then. I think it's pretty cool. But to talk about some of the things that you mentioned about the cons here, one is I think that make sure that your staff, your technical staff, understands the principles, because you bring in new skills that are, you know, to a new environment. You want to make sure that people are there, so for incident and problem management. As well, I think also, you know, because we have virtual servers, you know, we can control our physical servers in the room, you know, for sprawl. But as we're adding all these virtual servers, if too many people have their fingers in the pie and it's not managed well, you can actually have virtual server sprawl as well.
Yeah, you got to be careful there, because you know you get so excited when you start playing around with virtual machines that next minute you start launching a virtual machine for every application. You know,
right? And
and then it becomes unmanageable, and then so the whole management side of it, I think, is where the competition is going to heat up, because that's where you need to know what's running, how you shut it down cleanly, can you decommission. So the whole process, let's say when you had a physical thing of commissioning a machine, running it, maintaining it, and decommissioning it, you know, because of the physical machine, it was certain processes and policies in place to do that. And I think management these days in IT infrastructure, you make sure that the virtual machines are still maintaining those same policies and principles in place, you know, commissioning and decommissioning machine. Because just quickly, one of the benefits, obviously, of virtualization is the ability to almost instantaneously provision servers for like business units in larger corporates. I mean, typically in the past, if you were running a project in the bank and you said, okay, let's go to infrastructure and get a machine, you know, then it's, oh, well, we have to order the machine from IBM, and it arrives 2 weeks later, then they have to put the operating system on it, and, you know, that takes another week before the machine's available to be used. Now, with virtualization, you can provision these machines because you can have templates for the machines and their setups and everything. They can be provisioned within minutes. So that's an advantage there, but it's also a danger, as you say, about you know, virtual machine sprawl, where you just have these rogue machines running that no one knows about.
And the other thing I want to talk about too, Mark, was it's kind of a pro and it's kind of a con all at the same time. So at the telco that I worked at, we actually used a virtual machine for a legacy application that we had that was DOS-based. But as you replace your equipment, we weren't able to find a server that would run that program. We had to run it virtually because they had not designed a program to replace it yet for that application. So that's a pro, right? You can run mm-hmm. some legacy programs on a virtual side. But the con was it comes back to a single point of failure when you have multiple applications running virtually on one server. And I know that one day our server room actually overheated and it affected half the country. But the security guard didn't realize the alarm was going off, that the heat was building in the server room. So everything shut down. And you would think we had some redundancy built, but I guess we can go into that another day. How about building redundancy into your systems? But it brought down our whole data center for half a day, and it was that's pretty serious when you're talking about a national telecom.
Yeah, I've heard this because a lot of the infrastructure guys, I think, you know, they just look at the hardware side, so they like all this redundancy and backups for hardware failures, to a degree, they oppose virtualization because they see it as now you've got a single point of failure with all these machines running on it. But I mean, if you architect, okay, obviously, if you've got, depending on the amount of money you've got, but let's say, you know, you're a bank, you can architect your solution in such a way that you've got a SanDisk. I mean, obviously, a SanDisk is all of that hardcore redundancy and snapshotting and everything that can happen there. Mm-hmm. And then you have your machine. So, you know, in fact, you've got a lot of redundancy now because essentially, instead of having redundancy all in, let's say each machine had to be set up to be redundant, you can just set up essentially one, you know, the disks, the one SAN server to be redundant and have all of the latest and greatest technology there. And then in terms of the CPUs and the memory and stuff, well, now you've got redundancy because you can just migrate your virtual machines. So, you know, when you've got the complex management infrastructure for your virtual machines, it'll detect. It almost becomes like automatic clustering and failover, all of those good things. So it'll automatically detect that the CPU is failing on the one box. It'll migrate the machines from the one server to the next. So all of those good things. So I think, you know, the potential even there for uptime and high availability, all of that with virtualization really exceeds what's currently available, you know, once it's architectured right. But I think that's the key thing. And people have to learn lessons there, how that's all done, how to architect it in such a way that you do have that redundancy.
And we were going to talk a little bit about networking, it can be kind of tricky with virtual machines. Is that correct?
Yeah, because the virtual machines can be tricky in the sense that you obviously only got one physical Ethernet card, or, well, it came out of more, but let's say in theory you've got one Ethernet card that's connected to the network and all these virtual machines are talking through that. So then, you know, each of the virtual machines need their own IPs. You need to also route between the host OS and the guest OSs. And so, especially on the desktop side, you know, you often hear the complaint that people have difficulty accessing the shares on the virtual machine from the host OS and stuff like that because of the difficulty around networking. It is becoming easier, but it is quite complicated. And, you know, as I said earlier, especially around the firewall rules, one of the approaches we take is we don't virtualize the firewall. We rather leave it in a physical box and then we virtualize the servers behind the firewall. Some guys you get, you know, they'll actually virtualize a firewall and run typically what they call their DMZ zone is virtual machines within the same box as running the virtualized firewall. You know, for me, that's so complicated, all the rules and whatever's going on there, that it's not worth the risk of getting one rule wrong and then having your whole system compromised. You know, I'd rather stick with a dedicated firewall sitting on the, you know, the perimeter of your network and then your servers and your DMZ, you know, they can be virtualized, but let the firewall handle all of the stuff in a normal manner. So I think it's extremely complex around networking, and people have to learn how to use it. And maybe also the tools have to be developed to make it easier, and you might have to rethink the way we conceptualize, you know, firewalls and rules around networking these days, because in the past it was tied to a physical machine. You know, you would also say, mm-hmm. okay, I want to block this particular machine and access, and you knew it was one machine. It was the machine sitting on rack 5, you know, row 2 kind of thing. And also it was easier to do. Now this machine can be sitting anywhere in your network. So it is, there's a lot of complexity and issues around that. Look, I'm not a big networking guy, so, you know, maybe some people out there know more about networking. It's much more easier than it seems. But, you know, I could quite easily handle physical networking and when machines were sitting on their own dedicated hardware. Now it's a lot more complicated, and the firewall rules, what's in, what's going out, what virtual interface, all that. It's a lot more complicated than it used to be now. I think that's the biggest challenge, actually, is with virtualization, will be around security and the whole networking side of it.
And it ties back again to what I said about, you know, proper training and getting the knowledge, developing your existing skills and competence so that you can enhance your systems with virtualization. Anything else you want to share, Mark?
Yeah, just look, one of the interesting things that's happening with virtualization is that it's, you know, all these virtualization technologies that are out there, it's basically a commodity. You know, that's thanks to open source. Otherwise, we'd be paying, you know, hundreds of thousands of rands or dollars just to get access to this. But where everybody's been forced basically to give the virtualization technology away for free, from Microsoft to VMware. And I think what you see happening is really where the competition is going to heat up between the vendors is around the management tools, especially for these data centers. You know, if you've got a small office with one or two, with one server that's virtualized, it's not an issue. But if you've got a massive data center with, you know, with thousands of virtual machines, you need a tool to help you manage provisioning those machines, monitoring them, taking them down, decommissioning them, and migrating them if there's any issues, that kind of stuff. You know, and that's where I see it heating up. So, for example, Novell has got their PlateSpin product out, which they bought recently, and I think that's going to give them quite a big competitive advantage. Now, I know also Red Hat's bought out their virtualization management software as well. And so what you find happening is the key thing is that everybody, and this is where the advantage for the open source community lies, is that you have to be agnostic now in terms of what operating system you're dealing with. And that's great because open source has always been agnostic. You know, we freely interoperate with any other operating system. And that's where Microsoft is a bit challenged now, because now they have to, you know, if they're going to do virtualization, they have to allow you to run Linux on top of Windows. Who would want to do that? I'm not quite sure. But, you know, that's one of the things they have to allow. And how you interoperate with Linux. I think this is also part of the reason why they, you know, with the whole Novell agreement as well, is because they realize now their customers are demanding this interoperability. And if they fight it, they're just going to, well, they're going to fight as long as they can. But in the end, they know they can't resist it. They have to basically learn to cooperate with these other operating systems out there. So, yeah, so I can't see Microsoft's virtualization technology taking off because of its history of security and its lack of reliability. You know, so I think it's a great advantage for Linux to actually move into the space and take over virtualization and run the Windows OSs where it's necessary as guest machines in the Linux hypervisor.
Right. Yeah, I agree with you on that, Mark.
Basically, all the virtualization technology is freely available in all of the operating systems. So the competition is really around managing of the virtual and machines. And what you see happening on Linux, for example, Red Hat bought out libvirt, which is quite nice. It's an APR, which, because all these virtual machines have their own APRs, of course, you want to manage it from the application. What libvirt does, it creates an abstraction layer across those various APRs. So if you program, you can program to the libvirt APR to control the various virtual machines, like reallocate memory, start and stop the virtual machines, you know, get resource usage stats from the virtual machines using libvirt. And that's one of the core libraries that's going to be used in building the sort of technologies around the management tools around virtualization. And another thing around virtualization is what's called containers. That seems to be the next phase of virtualization. A container is a much lighter weight form of virtualizing your machines. So, for example, it will mainly be in like Linux, where you're virtualizing a Linux machine. But it's very lightweight, and it's much easier to manage and maintain. So, for example, one of the technologies that's currently using containers is OpenVZ. OpenVZ, I haven't used it myself, but it's something that I want to, I've heard a lot of talk about and I want to try, because essentially it allows you to do live migrations of your virtual machines without the need for a central disk backend, you know, because most of these machines, when they say, we're going to show you a live migration of the machine, it works because there's a centralized disk at the back of those machines. But OpenVZ doesn't require that. So that's one thing which intrigues me, especially for, you know, like smaller companies where you don't have the money to go and buy a big expensive SAN solution, to have centralized disks at the back end there. And so yeah, containers apparently will be coming in the later, you know, in the years to come, will be in the Linux kernel as well. Yeah, and I think it's just going to be another form of virtualization which might be a little bit simpler to use and manage than the current virtualizations that we have.
All right. Well, Mark, I just wanted to add my final comment in that, you know, I think virtualization is rapidly becoming adopted only because, as you previously mentioned, I think it's so cost-effective. And with the crunch, everyone is feeling budget crunches around the world that, you know, to be able to reduce, again, your hardware costs, your power costs, you know, the infrastructure costs and behind all of that is very attractive. And maybe that's why it's been dormant for 40 years and now it's finally coming to the forefront.
I think it's also been dormant, you know, CPUs now have reached that level of speed where it's actually quite easy to, you know, you don't notice a big degradation in performance when you start up the virtual machines now, potentially. Whereas years ago, maybe the hardware just wasn't fast enough to handle it.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, and I also had touched on that with the shared desktops. I feel that, in my experience anyway, that each user wouldn't even know that they were actually sharing a machine. I know that we've had some issues with flash sites, you know, flash-intensive games and so on. But generally, for the ordinary user, there's really not a degradation in their performance.
Yeah, especially for desktop virtualization, you know, most people don't use a tenth of their machines they've got anymore. And that's especially true now that, you know, a lot of the applications have moved to the web. Whereas before, it was this, where you had a client-server environment where you had these bloated softwares like Microsoft Office that would run on the client machines. You know, you needed quite a potentially powerful desktop to run it. But now a lot of the applications are... Yeah, it's almost moving back to the mainframe days and running on the central server where all the power is sitting. So it also reduced the need for all of that excess power on the desktops.
Right, and has removing into things like cloud computing and, you know, things like Google Docs and all those kind of applications. You're right. We don't need to load anything and have it natively on our desktops anymore.
And another advantage, which, you know, you briefly mentioned about, you're talking about your dev environment running in a virtual machine, an advantage of that. You know, the advantages of virtualization will include the ability to snapshot your and back up your entire environment, your production or your dev environment, you know, in a live state, because obviously just using disk backend technologies allows you to take disk snapshots. And that's what's great about one of the advantages of virtualization is the ability to do that, ability to quickly and easily back up your entire operating system. And since it's running in a virtual environment, it's quite easy to get up and running again. You don't have to go and find the specific hardware that it was running on. You know, typically if you back up your machine, you try and reinstall it in a machine that's got different hardware, different RAID controllers,
let's say,
all that kind of stuff. It was difficult to do that. Now, because all of the hardware is essentially virtualized, you know, once you've got your virtual environment set up, you can quite easily restore a virtual machine. And more you're noticing as well that all the different server technologies, virtualization technologies out there can read each other's disk images. So especially between KVM and Xen, for example, KVM can run Xen images, or there's work on that. I'm not sure if it's out yet, but I know Red Hat was talking about it, where they can run Xen or KVM images within KVM or the next release that's coming out. So, you know, that kind of stuff is really very beneficial. I mean, you can take, essentially now you can take a server home with you to test or to a different environment and you can test it and, you know, without too much schlep or hassle to do that. And another thing we also see where virtualization is coming into its own is in terms of these virtual appliances. Now, if you're a company and you've got some product and you want people to download it and test it, typically it was a bit of a mission because people have to download it, or they have to install MySQL, then I'll have to install Apache, deploy your web service, you know, install your database schema, all of those things, which, you know, for a lot of people who just want to try it out, like business people just trying out your application, that was a challenge. Because, you know, you need quite a bit of knowledge to configure it. Now you can just provide a virtual image of your application. People can download that and run it and test your application. So it really, it was also quite good from a marketing point of view.
Yeah, because I know when I downloaded Joomla to start testing it, I had to do all of the things you were talking about. I had to configure my SQL, and I had to do Apache, and I had to do all these things. And yeah, so it might be a little daunting for people to be doing that. All right. Well, I think that's about all I have to add, Mark.
Yeah, that's all. I'm just trying to think if there's anything else that we've missed or overlooked, because it's quite a broad subject, and it's moving so fast that, I mean, I've last sort of looked at virtualization probably about 6 months ago, but it's moved a lot since then, so there's a lot happening in that space.
Yeah, it sure is. And I'm sure that we'll be able to do another episode in 6 months from now, and things will have changed as well. Okay, I don't know if I have much more to add to this. I think it's been really a good session today, and I hope that our listeners got some good knowledge. And we look forward to some comments on the episode. How about you, Mark?
Yeah, I think that covers a lot of what we want to talk about in terms of the pros and cons of virtualization. You know, why would somebody want to do it? And what is virtualization? And we covered the different aspects there of hardware-assisted virtualization, para-virtualization, and full virtualization. So I think that's a wrap.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.